Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
May 25th, 2015, episode number 78, Getting Ahead of the Curve. Welcome, everyone, to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin England. I'm recording on a holiday weekend. This morning is Memorial Day, Monday, and I've just finished my bowl of steel-cut oats with toasted almonds and raisins, and I'm enjoying a cup of Ethiopian Ergashefi coffee brewed from a batch that I roasted last weekend in my little hobby coffee roaster. It's a quiet morning around the England household on what appears to be a glorious-looking day weather-wise. I spent a good number of hours this weekend on bee projects, cutting the grass in the yards, prepping equipment, and, well, this podcast are a few things that I've had on tap. I do plan on spending the remainder of the day on projects in the garage, the ones that I've never finished over the winter break, and now I have a free day to get them out of the way. You'll hear later some of the notions of the pursuit, and I enjoy these little projects because each ends in a little gratification of an output that I can hold in my hands, say an assembled nuke box or a finished bottom board and such. I guess since I have a lot to cover, I should get started. I can run down of some of what's in store for this episode. First up is a notion about being behind the curve and finding a way of getting ahead of the curve. We recently covered beelining at the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association. I have a primer on that. Discussion about the book, The Language of the Bees. An update of what's being reported at the New Jersey Swarm Report. Sharing a little bit about a water bucket dilemma. Some commentary about YouTube views and recent video posts. A listener email on successful swarm trapping. And maybe some other things thrown in along the way. We'll see how ambitious we get. First off, and as usual, the local hive report. Let's dive into the local hive report. Four hives on the property at the beginning of our report, and I'll give some context to that in a moment. Three of the hives overwintered. One of them was a package install that we did at the Beekeepers Association meeting that I purchased and brought home. Let's talk about the three hives that overwintered. Two of them were smallish in size. One of them was moderate in size. The moderate hive was two deep boxes with a medium over top of it as a honey box to feed them coming out of winter. During the wintertime, they moved up into that medium, and I did a hive rotation, put that medium box in the middle. My initial thought about that box was to let the queen run in there and eventually pull that out of the center of the stack and make it a brood chamber for an all-medium hive. There was a question in our last episode about how it would progress. Would the bees move from the medium up into the top deep, or would they go down, or would they fill all three? The answer is up. Bees move up, right? That's a common wisdom. I've talked about bees move sideways, they move to where space is. But in this case, it makes sense to me that they went up because of the fact that the heat is up. It's still been relatively cool at night, and I think they're not going to move down until it's perpetually warmer so that they can get closer to the entrance, but they're going to go where the heat is. So upon the last inspection, the bees are up in the top box there. And whatever brood was in that medium box, which was at the top of the stack, is emerging. And eventually, I think the queen will lay across the top and then move back down into that medium. The conundrum for me is, will they grow big enough to go into that third box down the bottom? And do I really want to mess with this hive? It's my best chance at getting some honey this year. And my preference would be not to disturb the workforce too much. Although I did pull one frame of brood out of it to make some splits, which I'll talk about later, so I have compromised it somewhat. But in this case, it's doing pretty well, and I'm going to let it run to its devices. And the fact of the matter is it's starting to get a little bit crowded, if I don't do something with it soon, it could potentially even swarm. So my plan is this afternoon to go put some honey boxes on it, just to give them a little more space. The other two hives, one of them is smallish in size. It's working on building out brood so that it can populate the two boxes that it has at its disposal. It's a slow starter, but it's getting its legs, so to speak. The third box is not in a good situation. That box, upon inspection, I have a drone-laying queen. She has run out of gas for whatever reason, and there is no signs of any brood patterns, and any bees that were there from brood after overwintering, which is comical, this box is dwindling, and I had to make a decision. I went through it and discovered that it did not appear to have a queen, and upon the next inspection, I went literally through every part of the box and found two queen cells. So I think they were in the premise of requeening. The box is loaded with nectar and pollen. Every area of it, the bees have been doing whatever they can to bring stuff back. But there's still no evidence of a queen. And it's probably going to take another 15, 20 days for this queen to get back in there, get established, if she makes it back, and get this hive up and running. By that time, the nectar flow is going to go away. So stick a pin in hive number 3, it was, on my pads. I'll come back to that in a second. The fourth hive was the package install hive. That hive has a story on its own. The queen appeared to be just getting started 2 weeks ago. She got in there. She had to get acclimated to the package. Sometimes they don't get in and start laying right away. They wander around in the hive, getting a sense of getting things in order. When I looked in there 2 weeks ago, the queen had started to lay, and she was laying multiple eggs in a cell. That's an interesting thing to find. You would expect when you're buying a package that they pulled a queen from a laying hive and she would have had patterns, and to get restarted, she would not need to practice. Practice is what I would call a queen who's laying for the first time and not laying multiple eggs in a cell. But in this case, and I shot a short video clip of it when I discovered it, there were 2, 3, sometimes even 4 eggs in the bottom of a cell throughout this one face where she started laying. I left the hive to its devices, and last week, 1 week ago, I looked at it, and there was one or two faces of the frames were full of brood. They were small eggs to larvae to literally on the cusp of being capped and in good way. So the queen found her way, and she's in there running like an engine in that package install. I wasn't quite sure how advanced they were going to be, and I wanted to make sure they had room. And it's been warm enough-ish to be able to give them a second box and entice them to go to town. That package started with all drawn comb, and my hope is after that first generation of workforces emerge, that box will boom and go. To that end, as a package, I am feeding it. I have an inboard division board feeder filled with one-to-one solution, and I'm keeping it topped off. Last week when I checked it still had quite a bit of stores left, but my guess is that they're able to find nectar out in nature, and they're not going to drink that if they have the ability to go to trees and plants and get real. But I'll keep it topped off because I want to make sure that hive has every advantage to grow. So 4 hives on the property. Let me talk about what I did this past week. I mentioned I pulled a frame out of the biggest hive I have. I also pulled a frame out of the second biggest hive I had, and I put them in a nuke box 2 weeks ago. With some nurse bees and with some nectar and pollen frames, I put them all together in the nuke. And last Saturday when I did the inspection, voila, I found queen cells. Some were capped, some were literally on the cusp of being capped. When I pulled the frame out and looked at it out of the big hive, it was loaded with brand new eggs, brand new spec eggs. and I knew it was a great candidate to make queen cells. Before I put it in the nuke, I used my hive tool to knock the floor out of the cells in order to entice them to build queen cells, and they built me 9 of them. It was on those 2 frames that I pulled, one full of just eggs and larvae, and the other one had some kept brood with new eggs around the outside of it. So I had 2 frames in my nuke with a frame of brood and a frame of nectar and pollen, and they had 9 queen cells on them. The hive that was not good, the drone-laying hive, was loaded with resources and some brood, and I made the opportunity to harvest that hive for the good of the apiary and split it into a number of other hives. So first things first, I cut each of the queen cells out and put them in the hives that I was making. I have a queen castle that has 3 chambers in it. 3 frames, 3 frames, 3 frames. I took a frame of drone brood and a frame of nectar and pollen. And those 2 things, I pulled 3 of those out and put them in the queen castle and went to an old hive and pulled drone comb and put them in. So each chamber has a frame of brood, drone brood, not real brood, a frame of nectar and pollen, and an empty frame. In the drone brood frame, which I put in the middle, I cut a hole and I stuck in a queen cell that I cut out. When you cut the queen cells out, sometimes they build them across a wire. So I took a kitchen knife and I cut a circle around the queen cell and then used some tin snips and cut the wires so that I could insert the plug into the frame. I had more queen cells, so I harvested more out of that box, the donor hive, and I put them in 2 nukes. And with those, I also put some nectar and pollen and 2 more queen cells in them. One of the things I did with one of the nukes was I pulled some frames out of my top bar hive, which is not operational, and I put them in there with the hopes that when the queen is going, she will eventually lay eggs in that frame, one of my top bar frames, and they'll store resources, and I could pull that out and put it in my top bar and get that started as wave number 2. After completing all this, I still had a couple of frames left. I pulled the donor hive off and put it away, and I pulled out an 8 frame hive that I had sitting in the garage and put that on the stand, and I put what was left in a package there, almost like a mini nuke. So if you're keeping score, an 8 frame hive with a pseudo nuke package in it, 2 nukes, and a queen castle with 3 chambers, all with queen cells ready to go. I don't know how these progressed. I'm going to look this afternoon when I go out to the yard and see how everything's going. But my hope is that they all did well this week. And if I count back to the clock, 2 weeks ago on a Saturday, I pulled these frames. And the incubation period for a queen is somewhere like 14 to 16 days. So the hope is that they've all emerged. Now, one of the challenges I had was I did this on a Wednesday night, came home early from work, and had to run to go to soccer practice. I'm not 100% sure that I got a good number of bees in these boxes to keep everything warm. And unfortunately, Wednesday and Thursday, it was a bit chilly. So I'm hoping they made out okay with the weather and protected the queen and whatever brood they had and resources. When I peeked in on them yesterday morning, I saw hives flying. So my guess is that they're okay in there, but we won't know until we know. So it's been an interesting week. I've built now to 9 hives. And then on Friday afternoon while at work, got a phone call from a friend who's a beekeeper. He has a couple hives. Not looking to have some more. He had a swarm hanging in his tree. Big swarm. Happy swarm. Went and collected that. And I put it in my polystyrene hive. And got that restarted. And I put that over on the new yard. So I had to mow that grass. It was shin high. It's been a while since I've been over there. And I went over with my weed cutter and cut it all down. And I mowed my yard on Saturday morning, the local yard. And what I think I'm going to do is let these hives get started, established, get my queens mated, and then I'm moving them all to the new yard where I know they get the first early morning sun and I know they have better access to resources. The debate is whether I should do that now or later, and I think I'm going to do it a little bit later. I don't want to be disruptive to these hives. Maybe that's a fool's notion, but that's the game plan that I'm going to follow. So now, if I did my math right, I think I have 10 hives started in some various form, and pretty excited about that. The package hive has been growing out. I'll get to take a peek in that this afternoon, check and see if it needs more stores. I'm hoping that it has cap brood through the bottom, and with one or two more emerged, it should fill out those two boxes and is on its way to a good start. The queen seems to be laying very well in there, so I'm happy about that. You hear all these rumors about package hives and whether they're good or not good or quality queens, blah, blah, blah. This is me living vicariously, and what I've been doing is shooting features with my video camera each week on the progress of this hive, and I call it the Package Hive series. You can follow it on our YouTube channel, and you can watch a day in the life. And if you've started a package hive recently, you could follow how I'm bringing one. And I have to admit, and I think I said this in the last episode, this is the first ever package I've purchased. I started with a couple nukes, and I've always built my own bees from doing splits, and this is an interesting foray for me to bring this in. I'm pretty excited about it, so good. That's the local hive report. There's a lot going on, and it's going to provide a lot of information going forward on how things progress. You can follow along with our season. I'm hoping that the nectar flow is going to stay reasonably good here in New Jersey. The problem is that we've had no rain. And I'm hearing down in South Jersey that things are really dry. State apiarist made a comment that when the trees are done blooming, it's going to be tough go for the bees. So maybe in the next 2 weeks we'll get a little bit of rain and salvage what's left of our forage season through to July 15th, which is the typical cutoff for us. It's even been a little bit slow in the swarm function, although I'll talk about the New Jersey swarm report progress a little bit later. It's been a little retarded in its start, a little slower than usual, and I'm getting ahead of myself. So, local hive report, check, all done. Pretty excited about what's going on. I love this time of season. Can I share that with you? Yeah. All right, before we get started into what we have for features this episode, let me just spend a moment giving my contact information in case you want to reach out. You can email me at kevin@bkcorner.org. As usual, the typical thing that I'll ask you is please let me know how to pronounce your name if you give it. And if you share anything with me, let me know that I'm free to share or not free to share with anybody. I do appreciate when everybody writes in and try to answer all of my emails. Been pretty good about that lately, I think. So our website is bkcorner.org. As we do the features, I'll tell you about show notes. You can go to bkcorner.org and look up the episode. This is episode number 78, and you'll find links and notes and things like that there. Okay, let's get started. Segment number one, I call this one Getting Ahead of the Curve. This is a bit of an observation piece. I had hoped to have Bob Kloss join me on the podcast, but he had a conflict and wasn't able to join me, so I'm going to go it alone here. Bob and I have been talking about the opposite poles of success for beekeepers this season. Some are doing very well and others are just plain struggling. Using the NWNJBA mentoring hives as a barometer, a few of them had reasonable but small number of bees on the cluster. This puts these hives in the penalty box as we see it. My personal hives, as I just described, have the same dilemma. I said in the opening that two of my three hives were small and the other one was medium coming out of winter. The problem with this dynamic is that the queen can't get to work. Even if she's good to go for the spring, she will not exceed the ability of her colony to maintain eggs as she lays. What I mean by that is she will need to build one or two sets of brood before she has the population to go hog wild laying brood. The penalty aspect of this is that she is stalled in her quest to build bees when the nectar flow is on and is squandering the opportunity of the bounty of spring. On the contrary, and in contrast, our friend Charlie Isley had some significant success last year, and his hives were in really good shape going into the winter. They came out with great resources, and he needs a stepladder to get to his honey boxes these days. This past week, his good fortune continues as his yard is within range of a grove of black locust trees, which provide abundant resources for his girls. It can be noted that Charlie has been laser-focused on his yard and manages his mites when needed and performed hive management techniques to prevent swarming. You could say he's on his game, and good for him. I spent some time out in my yard mowing the grass Saturday morning and continue to recognize that my bees don't get sun till around 10:30 in the morning. The bad news is that it's been pretty cold each morning. To that end, it was in the 40s last night or the night before and has been for a number of days before that. And yesterday morning it was 45 degrees in the morning and not likely that our bees were going to fly anytime. I think that's pretty common everywhere, but I also know, as I've said, I'm in a hole in the floor in the valley and we have a bit of a microclimate, which is a little bit cooler than everybody else surrounding us, which is even more detrimental. I just stated that we had very minimal rain this spring, which is good and bad. Good because with warmth that comes during the middle of the day, the bees can go out as much as they want and forage almost until dark, which comes about 8-something at night. And foraging does go on in earnest, but the question is, without moisture, is there any nectar in these plants? Are they dry or are they plump? I don't think they're very plump. And this is going to be not so great. They'll be out burning all their energy looking for something that's not there. So as I just said in the local hive report, some of these starter hives need to get going and I'm going to have to move them out of the yard. I know in the other yard they'll get morning sun and be up and out earlier, which tends to, in my mind, and rationalize that plants probably have more forage due to the morning dew than in the middle of the day when they're beaten down on the sun and they dry up and retract a little bit. So the nectar flow is going to dry up here by July 15th, and I'm going to have to commit to feeding these hives in order to get them to some shape where they can get to the fall nectar flow, if we happen to have one, and get them big enough to overwinter and be big colonies like the ones I described for Charlie Isley. So the notion of getting ahead of the curve, I want to strike on that tune a little bit. And this was an observation by Bob, and he and I have been talking about this recently. Picture the scene of a weak hive in contrast to a good hive that is going to go gangbusters. On the weak hive, they've come out of winter with a couple frames of bees, and the queen only has the capability of laying brood in the pattern by which the bees can protect it. By the way, they just came out of winter. These are old bees, destined to be replaced. So she lays that first crop of bees, and they emerge, and they replace the old bees, but the population doesn't go up that much. She lays the second round of bees, and they emerge, and now she has the ability to lay more brood, but she still doesn't have a big population. Maybe the third generation, she now starts to get to a workforce. Contrast that to the hive that came out of winter with a really big colony. They're building bees. And they're building bees. And the bees that they have are out foraging. And they're out bringing back nectar and pollen to build more bees in the early spring. By the time the first hive has the ability to build some population to go out and forage, they've missed part of that spring fling. The second hive is going into their second box with a plethora of bees when the full-on nectar flow comes in the springtime, and they're good to go and off to the races. By week 3 or 4 of the spring, The starter small hive has gotten to a moderate-sized workforce, and the early season forage has been missed. Maybe the forage is going to continue, but if you have a second half of springtime that's rainy or dry like it is now in New Jersey, where there's not plant nectar because the plants are dry, they don't roll. And then they come to the dearth, and they have a moderate-sized bee colony, not a ton of resources, as contrasted by the other one, which has packed it on, has a good number of bees, can go through the dearth. The dwindle of the population is not going to hurt them that much. And then they start hitting that nectar flow for fall, and she starts picking up in the big hive, and boom, they build a good population, and they grow to the point where they can overwinter and repeat the pattern. As long as that queen stays functional, that good hive is going to continue to operate season after season. The other hive is just scraping along. And that seems to be a little bit of what I've been experiencing. So the detriment of my yard and a couple other things have brought me to this conclusion. And one of the observations, take myself out of it, is the mentoring yard that we have at Northwest. Those hives were in good shape last year coming out. But one of the things that occurred during the summertime is the county cut the field down by which they forage. They have the bounty right in front of them of a multi-acre field of diverse forage that's been let to grow on its own. The county was doing fireworks. They cut the entire field down so that when it was dry, it would not spark and burn the whole field. But yet, when we went and looked at it a couple weeks ago for spring, there's nothing in there. Now, it's starting to come back, but as we walked through the field while the bees were out foraging, there's no bees in the field. They've lost their supermarket, so to speak. And the bees that came out of winter in there have second-year, third-year queens. They're a little bit weaker. They're not as strong and banging as they should be. So they're smaller colonies. The other side effect of those hives in our mentoring yard is we do a lot of damage to them. Not on purpose, but just the fact that we sheerly use them for demonstrations and we take them down to the bottom boards. We've made splits out of them a good number of years in a row. We're doing intrusive inspections when we do all-day mentoring sessions. And we've been pulling bees out of them and taking them to county fairs for observation hives. I mean, that's their purpose. But what we know and what we've been discussing, given this conundrum that the field's not very good shape right now, and the clusters have taken a hit because of the amount of harvesting that's been done with them, is that we need to build more hives over there and do more work and get these. You almost need to have like rested hives working in the background to help augment and restore what's available in the other hives that are being harvested for a couple county fairs and a good number of demonstration days that we do. We did somewhere around, I want to say, a dozen to 15 events last year where we were putting together observation hives out of those. So they get their fair share of use and utility. So this whole dynamic is not really the whole picture. You have to take into other considerations, and I won't go through a lot of them, but in contrasting those scenarios, you have to take into account the other inputs, treatments, types of bees, meaning race of bees, whether you insulate your hives or not, how you're feeding your hive, beekeeper intrusions, bears competing for resources with so many bees in one particular area, and other factors. There are so many different dynamics that play into hive colony growth that this is just one notion or one aspect of the whole big picture. So the segment was really about pointing out some observation for our mentoring hives and a few things that have been in play with my local hives. It always comes down to foundation. You need good nutrition, lots of resources, plenty of bees, and healthy, vibrant queens. And oh yeah, it's something I'm kind of guilty of. A beekeeper to let them be and let them do what they're supposed to be doing. So it's really just not about overwintering your bees. That's the new epiphany and the takeaway that goes into the vault. It's not about overwintering your bees. It's about having a large enough colony to sustain and keep operations going. It doesn't hurt to be somewhere near a locust grove. I've always heard over and over again, people who have success, somehow in the background, there's always a black locust forest in their vicinity. And I think one of the things I'll do when I scout a new yard, and I do always keep my eyes open, is for someone who's going to plant forage, meaning clover fields and things like that for the bees to work on, and or some vicinity near black locust for its lore that it is always a great bounty at this time of year. Black locust just came in last week, I'm hearing. The bees are working it. And when they do, they apparently have just a... It's like the buffet in Las Vegas, man. As much as you could eat. And that really is helpful for the bees to have that amount of access to resources. If they can get diversity of pollen and black locust or that plethora of stores, you're on your way to no problems from a feeding and whatever standpoint. But I'm off on a tangent. Survival of the bees needs a large colony and good healthy mix of food. Not very difficult to figure out. Segment number two is about bee lining. If you're not familiar with this term, bee lining is a technique used to find hives in nature. It's an interesting concept. We tried a few new things for our May 16th NWNJBA meeting. I was talking to our executive board about, we have a reasonable number of members that have been with us a number of years. And when we do our hands-on and we talk about splits and hive inspections or whatever, they've been there and done that, maybe even for a couple seasons. So we always like to try and make sure we're mixing in diversity in our plan. And this May 16th, our meeting included hands-on and two sessions, one of them being beeline. In this segment, I'll focus on beelining, but I'll mention what the other segment was, which is called fishing for drones. I worked in my garage at night over the last few weeks to build out some beelining boxes. I used a reference design that I saw on the web and just kind of engineered it. I know people always ask me when I build these things, what are the plans? I just built it in the garage. I don't have any. Anyway, I inherited a significant project at work recently with my team, and it's been a bit stressful. So going out and building something in the garage has been good medicine. So what is a beelining box? It's a single box with two chambers and the ability to open a door and capture a bee on one side. And then you slide a divider out of the middle between the chambers so that the bee can go into the second chamber and find some comb with nectar on it that you've placed there. The premise being that when they get a taste of it, they'll take the report of the nectar as a source and go back to the hive and report it and recruit bees to come back to your location. The far end of the bigger box has a clear panel on it, and it has a sliding cover that comes off to let light in, and I'll explain why in a second. So the way you use this contraption is you load some honeycomb, small little segment of it, with some nectar in the distant chamber and close off the center divider. You wander out into the field and you capture some bees in the far end, or in the close end, whichever way you want to perceive it. And then you pull that center divider out, and the bee walks across, they get a taste. But there's a little bit of procedure in this. So you collect the bees, you go back, you put it on a table, you slide the divider out, and you also slide the end cap off so that light comes through, and it draws the bees into the far chamber where the comb is. Once you look through the end where the glass is, or plexiglass in the case of the one that I built, and you know bees are down with the comb, you cover the whole thing with a dark cloth so that no light shines through. Because otherwise, the bees will go to the light And even if you took the cover and covered off the glass end, the cracks in the seams would allow light to spill through, and the bees would be wandering around on the cracks instead of going and discovering the comb. So you collected some bees, you removed the center divider, you put the thing on a table, you let the bees walk in, it's in a covered environment, and let it sit for about 5 minutes, and they'll find the comb, and they'll find the nectar, and they'll get a taste of that. Once they have a taste of that, after about 5 minutes closed off, you're going to let them out, and they'll fly back to the hive and report your location. You'll know if you got it right when you let them out and they come out and they circle and take a reading of where they are. They'll look at the landscape, they'll look at the location, and then they'll fly off in the direction of the hive. So as you release them, watch what they're doing and see if you can determine which direction they go in. So it takes a while for them to come back. They have to go back to the hive, they have to go inside, drop off their bounty, and they have to waggle dance and tell everybody where they're at. But eventually, if you've done this well, they will return to your location for some more. And the one thing I didn't note about this is the nectar that you're giving them is not just sugar water. It's got a couple drops of a volatile oil in it that they will recognize when they fly back. In the case of this, you use anise. It's that licorice-smelling extract, and I'll explain why in a moment. So you're going to send the bees off. They're going to go back to the hive, waggle dance, and then they'll eventually come back to you. While they're eventually coming back, you can go out to the hive or to the field and collect more bees and do this some more. So you get as many recruits as possible going back to the hive, and hopefully they're all coming from the same place. Once you've released all your bees, you come back to your table and you set up a lid. There's other parts of the equipment for this. You use a peanut butter jar lid is what I used. And you put a couple drops of anise extract in it. And then you put a screen over it. And then you take your little piece of comb and you put it on top of that screen. And the premise of the anise is they can smell. Bees don't have noses, but they can smell, by the way. They can detect that anise, something about their olfactory system that is the product of choice. I learned this method by watching Tom Seeley demonstrate this at an EAS meeting in Hershey, Pennsylvania. His commentary was that over time, people have established that anise is the best product. You could use other things like lavender and so on, but anise, it's the right one. For some reason, it's the one the bees can find. So you set your comb out on the screen, and the screen is to protect the bees from getting into the anise extract that you put inside because that has alcohol in it, and you don't want them to get that. And so to that point, you're going to use, you know, if you go to a restaurant, you take a shaker that, or not a shaker, a squirt bottle that has ketchup or mustard in it. That's what I use to fill my sugar solution. And I put 2 drops of anise in it. That's all you need for that. And that's what you're sprinkling in the comb. Now the bees will smell that and come back and take a taste of the comb. First time they come, let them be. Let them have it. They've found you. Good. They're going to forage and they'll go back to the hive. Then after a while, when they're coming and going, then you could start painting them, and you will paint them with a dot on their thorax or their tail. Don't paint their wings, obviously. You don't want to deter them from flying. And you could paint them a color, red, blue, white, whatever color you have on hand, different colors. And then once you paint them, when they return, you set your timer for when they leave and how long it takes for them to come back. The first time they leave, after you let them out of the box, they're going to orient in circle, and then they'll go off in the direction of the hive. But once they come back and get a taste of that nectar in the comb, they're going to come up, and they're going to fly right in the direction of the hive. So you'll have a little notebook, and you'll be taking notes as to which direction they're going in. And you could time how quickly they come back, because the timing gives you a sense of how far away the destination hive is. So I mentioned I learned this after watching Tom Seeley do it. Tom's a noted researcher, and he wrote the book Honeybee Democracy. And his work with the bees in the Arnett Forest, which I'm presuming he found using this method, is practical experience on how this works. He also mentioned that he used a book called The Bee Hunter. It's a paperback by George Harold Edgell, E-D-G-E-L-L. You could probably find that on Amazon.com. And at that presentation at EAS, Tom went through a good number of the pointers. And do note that I am literally parroting what Tom taught us. I don't have any practical experience on this. I guess I should have offered that disclaimer up front. But he said he learned this by others who have shown him and by practical experience, of course. So at some point, you're timing the bees going back and forth, and you want to now move in the direction of wherever the destination is. You take your little comb sample that you've had sitting on the wire and you put it back in the box and you let the bees come and you collect them. And as you're collecting them, you close the box. You walk 100 yards, 200 yards, whatever the next clearing is, toward the direction you think the hive is, and you open the box. And when they leave, they'll come out, they'll recognize they're in a new place, they'll orient, and they'll fly back to the hive. And if it were 15 minutes between trips, you would hope that the next time it'll be 10 minutes or 11 minutes between trips. That tells you you got a little bit closer. And you just keep repeating the process until you basically find whatever the hive is that you're seeking following back. And I always wondered, if you tried this in New Jersey, given the number of hives that people host, would you track yourself back to somebody's apiary, or would you actually find something in a forest? That is the premise of doing this, by the way, is it's been used in ancient times and right up until current times for people to find feral hives. And with the attraction of feral stock these days, this would be an interesting thing to try if you were trying to figure out where you could potentially find feral hives, something that I have an interest in doing this year. So we practiced this at our meeting last week. I should note that this is the wrong time of the year to do it. We did it more as a demonstration purpose. When there's abundant nectar, your little measly comb with a couple drops of liquid are not what the bees are looking for. But if you do this in July, August, early September before the goldenrod, when there's nothing out there, they will consider you a source and come back repeatedly. So there's a good number of questions about how this works and mechanics and other things. Let me run through a bunch of stuff that I know from this to round out the topic, so to speak. So the first thing is comb. And this is in no particular order. The comb is probably a 3-inch by 3-inch piece. When choosing comb for feeding bees, make sure it's the old, hard, brown comb. New comb is a little bit fragile, and you're going to be handling it. You want to make sure you use the dark old comb, as it's a bit sturdier. The liquid, as I said, is something like a 2-to-1 sugar solution. You might want to make it a little heavier in sugar. You want it to have a little viscosity and body to it, with only a drop or two of anise extract. It should not be watery when you do it, and you know, you're going to be moving the comb around. You don't want it spilling all over the place. And do be mindful of your liquid solution and your anise or whatever. I used a little bit of tray, small little tray that I had out of an old toolbox, and all my stuff in it. And if you spill stuff inside the tray, they'll come to the tray instead of your source. And I did that, and I literally had to put the tray inside my truck so that it wouldn't be the attractant. I just mentioned the time of the year. We did the demonstration and didn't really intend to track bees back. We did it in the lower part of the field where the mentoring hives were. And at some point, we couldn't find any bees foraging. That morning, it rained, and there weren't any bees available. It rained on the way to the meeting, literally, and the bees weren't out foraging. Partway through the meeting, the sun broke. The bees started going out and orienting and doing whatever. By the time they got out to the end of the field where we were, the meeting was over. So what we did was we actually went up to the mentoring hives, collected a bunch of bees, brought them back, gave them a taste of it, and let them go and let them go back. That's cheating, I know. But anyway, it did demonstrate the principle of this. And we did actually get some bees to return, which was kind of cool in an experiment. So time of the year, right time to do this is when the dearth is on. I'm just making sure I emphasize this so you don't go out and try it this week if the nectar flow is on and say, hey, Kevin, it didn't work. Departure or return times. One of the things to consider is if you paint a bee and it returns, how do you calculate how far the bees are? There's probably a bunch of books out there that tell you how to do this. If I paint one with a red dot and one with a yellow dot, if the red one leaves and returns in 3 to 5 minutes, the hive is really close. Tom Seeley estimated about 0.2 miles for a 5-minute turnaround. I could tell you that when we were in EAS, the bees he had returning were about 5-minute rotations and we were 0.2 miles. So he did that, the math added up. If it's a little bit longer, then you have a little more work in tracking the bees back to the source. And, you know, as I said before, remember the first time they have to go back, they have to do that communication of where the source of food is, so they'll be a little bit longer. Ideally, you want to get about 10 bees or so started, going back and forth and painted, so you can watch them leave and determine what direction they're going in, and have enough recruits going back and forth that you have a good steady flow, and you can follow them back to the source. Marking the bees, going back over some of the mechanics of this, don't mark them on their first trip. You want them to have a positive experience, as Tom said. On the second return, you can paint them. What do you use? You could use whiteout, nail polish, bee marking pens, and so on. I will tell you that I brought some nail polish, and it had a strong odor to it. And as soon as you got close to a bee, they detected that odor, and they flew off. So see if you could find something that's less volatile, doesn't have, you know, nail polish is meant to dry really quickly. It's got some pretty brazen chemicals in it. Maybe you want to go with something a little more water-based and not worry about it drying so quickly. And it would probably be less detrimental to the bees. I literally chased the bees around the table with the dropper trying to get them painted. And as soon as I got close, I could smell the acetone or whatever's in there, so I know they can, and they flew away really quickly. It became difficult to paint them. You know, you're going to use different colors so you can tell which bees are coming back. From the timing standpoint, paint the bee on their thorax if possible, but sometimes they get spooked as you approach them. You could also paint them on the tip of the abdomen, but as I said before, don't paint them on the wings. You only need a speck. That's all you need, just enough that you could see the color when they come back. One thing that was noted about following the bees back to the hive, just because they're going off in direction to your left doesn't mean the hive is to your left. Bees will follow pathways, so to speak. So sometimes they'll go to the left and then they'll get to that pine tree and make a right. And you'll discover that as you follow them along their path. They don't necessarily always fly the most direct route back, is what we were told. And I've read somewhere recently that bees actually follow highways and other pathways. They literally like to follow some sort of landmark, which I thought was interesting. Sometimes you read in these books about triangulation. Take a sample from one area, take a sample from another area, and see which direction they go off and use a map or GPS to plot triangulation. Your mileage may vary with that. According to Tom, he's tried it. Sometimes when it's really difficult to try and hone in on that last part, you can use it. But he said in general, he thought the estimates with triangulation were very noisy and leave you with a lot of ambiguity and weren't very useful. The weren't very useful part is my commentary, but that was my takeaway about his body language from it. You know, if you're going to be doing this, how long does it take you to follow a hive back? It depends. It depends on how close you got when you picked them up. It might be a few hours. It might literally take a few days to trace them back. One of the things Tom said is that if you come back the second day, if they're really desperate, you'll see bees returning the next day to that same spot, and you could pick up where you left off again, which I thought was very interesting. So I think I've covered everything that was in my notes here about bee lining. My guess is you could probably find some books, including the one that I referenced earlier that Tom mentioned. I'll see if I can find that in Amazon and provide a link in the show notes. If you have any practical experience with this and you want to write in and tell us about it or come on the podcast, I'd be happy to interview somebody, especially if you found some hives. I think that would be really cool. My thought is to see if I can find some time this August to maybe take a weekend, go out to a field somewhere remote, and see if I can find a feral hive. The one lead-in I had on a feral hive for swarm trapping went south, as the hive apparently did not make it through the winter. But to me, I'm like the tortoise who wins the race. It might take me a couple seasons to track this down, but at some point I'm going to find something. You know, we were talking, Bob Kloss, about in August just going out into the woods and walking around. There's a large stretch of preserved area along the Lakaton Creek, not too far from our home, that I think would be interesting to walk around and just see. You know, every time I go out to these places, it's typically for a Boy Scout hike or some other thing. Just not spending personal time out in the woods. And I'm wondering if I went out there and wandered around, would I be able to find anything? That's an interesting notion to me and one that I'd like to try someday. So over the next few seasons, maybe the opportunity will present and we'll see how that pans out. So let me talk about that other thing that I glanced over. I mentioned at the opening of the segment that we did a second feature presentation on fishing for drones. They purchased a weather balloon and hooked it up to this netting contraption that we created and flew it at our meeting to see if we could attract some drones. What we did was a practice run for the June meeting that we're doing for the state. The logistics of what we did was a story on itself. Blowing up the balloon and keeping the package below the balloon light enough, meaning the net thing, to actually fly was an exercise in science and physics. And then finding some queen pheromone and engineering the fishing line so it would not break and let the balloon fly away was another place of focus. I was thinking about how to engineer this contraption so that I could fly it with confidence of it not going away, and then maybe attaching a GoPro to it for the June meeting. I still have that notion. So we had a good time doing it, learned quite a bit, but didn't have a great success story. Like the bee lining thing, it didn't go overly well. I mentioned it. The morning of that meeting, it stormed, and the bees were not out foraging, including the drones. When we were wrapping up for the day, we saw the bees were just starting to forage in earnest, and a lot of the drones were coming out. If we had the balloon flying, we probably could have attracted some of them then, but we had already brought it down. My guess is if it had been a normal Saturday morning, and the bees would have got up early with the sunrise, that we probably would have had some success. But as it was, we did have a few bees here and there that were attracted to it, and it wasn't a total wash. So Bob Kloss had some old queens, ones that he's retired from service, so to speak, and rather than just discard them, you know, what do you do with a queen layer? Not a queen layer, a drone layer. You take them and you put them in a vial with some alcohol, and as they decompose, it makes queen pheromone that you could use for swarm traps. In this case, Bob had some, so that's what we used. We poured the juice, the alcohol from the queen concoction, on a cotton ball and attached that underneath the balloon, and it was enough to attract a couple bees, which was pretty cool. You know, part of the story was the balloon that we bought, getting it blown up. We looked at renting various tanks and so on, but the cheapest alternative was that morning just to go to a party store and have them blow the balloon up for about $10. So we stopped in the party store and had some amusement with the store employees, who were a bit perplexed on how to blow up a weather balloon. We wanted it as big as we can get. And what I bought was this. I bought two types of balloons, one like a huge monster one and one that was moderate in size. Well, the one moderate in size wasn't as big as I thought it was, and unfortunately had to be blown up to the absolute extreme of its capacity in order for it to actually work. The woman blowing the balloon up blew it up, but was ducking behind the counter the whole time in case it blew up. And I have to admit that me and my co-beekeeper who went into the store were kind of stepping back away from the counter as the thing looked really taut and very scary. And they actually had the hardest time tying the thing off. So what we know is that balloon was too small for the exercise. Now, the other balloon I have is 6 foot in diameter. It's true, honest to goodness, weather balloon, like you would see if you picture a weather balloon from NASA on the hobby scale, of course. The problem with blowing that up is it was 6 foot in diameter, wouldn't fit in my truck. So what we're looking at is figuring out some sort of tank rental for helium to take it out and blow it up live in person at the beekeeping meeting in June. I was trying to keep costs down for experimentation. You pay for the balloons, you pay for the tank, you pay for this, you pay for that. Next thing you know, it's quite a bit of money. One of the other questions I had is you could buy two types of tanks. You could buy a $70 tank, which is the full-size one. It'll blow up this thing, no problem. But you could also go to a local store and buy a smaller one that's meant to blow up balloons for somebody rental, a rental for a party. I don't know if that's got enough stuff in it to blow up a 6 foot diameter balloon. I suspect it does, but what if it doesn't? That becomes a difficulty. So if you have practical experience with one of these things and you think it'll blow up a 6 foot balloon, I'd love to hear from you, because I really think I'm looking at buying a big tank, which is $70 for a single shot. And I really don't want to do that, but I also don't want to go through all this motion not to have the balloon big enough to fly. So the other factor in this is we're fishing for drones. We're going to a location in Basking Ridge, where the meeting is, Liberty Corner. And we're bringing in hives to do inspections on Wednesday. And they might have some drones in it. But we actually are hoping that there's hives in that locale that when we fish, we can find local drones. And not just the ones from the ones we brought, which may or may not be flying in a drone congregation area. So there's a lot of ifs in this scenario, but at minimum, flying the balloon, telling the story, it'll be a neat thing, novel for beekeepers, and I don't think anybody in our beekeepers association, except for somebody like Stan Wozzetowski, who knows the guy who came up with this method, as he told me, Stan knows everybody, has ever seen something like this before. So it'll be a neat feature for the meeting and worth whatever outcome comes of it. Yeah, I can't wait to get that six-footer up in the air, shoot some video. That's what things have boiled down to in my life lately. It's about finding these fun things to do for features of the podcast for you folks. So I hope you appreciate it. All right, enough on that. Let's go on to segment number three. Segment number three is called The Language of the Bees. I've always enjoyed reading, but never had blocks of time to sit and dedicate myself to the hours it takes to read a novel. I'm more apt to read an article in Popular Mechanics or on the web, but reading books is pastime for vacation for me. It might sound odd, but I have an objective of reading at least one book a year while on vacation, and sometimes that doesn't sit well with Sharon and the boys because I might go off in a corner and read something straight through for 12 hours or in 2 6-hour chunks. It's an odd dynamic when someone on your vacation goes away as a recluse, and it never worked over the last couple of years, but I do really still enjoy reading that way, at least getting some sort of reading in. I'm happy to say Sharon and the boys are what I'll call readers. Sharon, I think, literally reads every night before she goes to bed, and the boys through their youth have always read a good number of books. Danny still reads when he gets a break from school. but he's usually preoccupied with that and his gaming. And Brian reads for school and just finished a book on his own, on the side, when he's not gaming. Last year, I decided to buy an Audible subscription for myself and see if it would afford me the opportunity to, air quote, read more books. Kevin moment. There's probably a better term for listening to recorded books, but in essence, I do feel like I'm reading them, even if someone is reading them to me. It always sounds odd to relay that I'm reading when, in fact, they are really performances of books in audible form. C'est la vie, I guess. End of Kevin moment. Nonetheless, it's helped me to exercise more. One of my favorite pastimes is to read while walking. And I've read 12 books since the subscription started. One thing about reading, listening to an audible book while you're walking is you tend to walk further. That's my experience. One troubling dynamic of doing this is you find yourself dangling all the time. I'm currently reading a book called The Scorch Trials. It is the follow-up to the book called Maze Runner. It's more like a kid's series, but I don't get fussy about that stuff. My wife and sons read The Maze Runner, and they wanted me to read it too because we were all going to see the movie about it after I get finished, which we did. And my guess is after The Maze Runner, there's probably another one to follow the series. I read a book called I, Sniper, which is my favorite so far of everything that I've read, and realized that it was one of many books of a series and went back to the beginning of the series to read Shooter, which is the book based upon the movie of the same name, starring Mark Wahlberg, which I always liked. And I know there are about six in that series. I read the Game of Thrones book, and there are clearly more to read in that series. Never watched the HBO show, but I did enjoy the book and get what all the fuss is about. And as the title of this segment goes, I read The Language of the Bees by Laurie King. I didn't know what to expect. I kind of picked it because of the title, duh. I was looking at my phone one day when it turned up in a suggested list, and I wasn't sure if it was a story or some sort of pseudo-documentary. I just didn't know, so I bought it to check it out. It was one of those dumb moments when I recognized that it was a Sherlock Holmes-based storyline. But I'm game for a good story and read this one straight through. The writer uses beekeeping as the plot line to get the book started, and it appears that it is the hobby that Sherlock Holmes took to, good hobby, Sherlock, when he retired as a detective. I can't say that I ever remember reading Sherlock Holmes books. I think I maybe read one of them. Nor did I know who Mary Russell is. Mary is Sherlock's apprentice after he retires, if you're not familiar with it, as I wasn't. So I've learned, and I enjoyed the story and the sidebar throughout the book about beekeeping. As with a series of books, there are a number of stories that came before this one, starting with The Beekeeper's Apprentice. I'm not sure if all these Mary Russell-centered books by Laurie King involve beekeeping, but my suspicion is that several of them do, given the titles of the one that I read, and, well, the one that follows of it is called The God of the Hive. So Laurie King did put out one short story that is apparently geared towards students, and it comes with a full package of information to supplement it for a school program. It appears to be geared toward 8th and 9th graders, and it has the elements that take you back in time and provide a good story and a factual representation of life in these times. You know, these books took place in the early 20th century, and as a note, it has themes of women's movement and the Great War and information about the roots of conflict in Europe and Middle East and expression of social and technical changes that were the underpinnings to our modern area as we live it today. I seem to get a sense that this writer has done a considerable amount of work to portray it in a way. So it's like a double bonus. You get to follow a Sherlock Holmes, Mary Russell story, and you get to learn about things, presumably factual, about the times and how they operated. And I won't give away the plot, but an airplane flight was discussed in a time when airplanes were just getting started. And it's fascinating to get the vantage point of view of somebody flying in an airplane for the first time and the difficulties of that. Anyway, one of the books that Laurie wrote is called Beekeeping for Beginners, and it's probably a great place to get a taste of this. The book description goes this way. Sherlock Holmes is fending off a particularly dark mood as he roams the Sussex Downs in search of wild bees. The Great War may be raging across the channel, but on the Downs, the great detective nears terminal melancholia, only to be saved by an encounter with a headstrong, yellow-haired young Mary Russell, who soon becomes the master's apprentice, not only in beekeeping, but in detection. So if you want to get a sense of who Mary Russell is, this is the book that introduces her and how Sherlock met her. And I kind of like the premise of it because it ties to the theme of beelining, which we just talked about, and imagine that the author is probably going to weave into an account of beelining in a factual way and how Sherlock did it to find wild bees. If this series is of interest, perhaps that's a good place to start. The indication is that this book introduces the adventure that led super sleuth Sherlock Holmes to discover his first and finest apprentice, Mary Russell. And again, it's probably a great place. It's 65 pages, 99 cents on Amazon for the Kindle edition, and appears very approachable. I'll provide a link on it in the show notes if you're interested in following the path. Over an hour in, and just getting to roundtables. I guess I ought to roll through these things and get you out of here. Roundtable number one, New Jersey Swarm Report update. I'm looking at the preliminary 2015 data so far in the New Jersey Swarm Report. It seems to me we're tracking about 2 weeks behind the last 2 years of reports since we got started. The count as I record this episode is 33 swarms reported so far. It could be noted that the swarm report has a page and some of them were reported to the state. No, I think that's been resolved. In the past, it was captured in two places and combined at the end of the year, but now it's all going to one place, which is good news. The pattern of what's going on right now is what I would say is more typical of what historically I thought was going to happen. Let me explain. Atlantic, Burlington, and Gloucester are leading the way, mostly from the southern part of the state in New Jersey. Recently, Union and Middlesex have weighed in with a number of entries. When we started this a couple years ago, we thought we would see the swarms kick off in the southern counties and then traverse to the northern counties. But the last 2 years, the statewide temperatures were even across the state, so swarming kicked off everywhere and not in one place in particular. This year, it was a smidge warmer in the south, and you might have hypothesized that they got things started for us with reporting some swarms, and then the north is now just starting to catch up. I always wonder if all these chimes and whatever show up on my microphone. Chime just went off about an email coming through. I'm getting Facebook pages. There's one on my phone. Sometimes the phone rings. It's very distracting. I don't know how much of that comes through, the squeaking of my chair and all that. It would be nice to have a professional studio without all these distractions, but I digress. So back to the swarm report. We got a decent representation so far from all corners of the state, yet we have no reports thus far from Hudson. One of my goals for 2015 is to get some from Hudson to report a swarm. 2 years and nobody's reported one. Guess they don't have swarms up there. So no swarms have been reported thus far from Hudson, Mercer, Morris, Ocean, Passaic, Sussex, and Warren County. I have to say that Mercer and Warren County are a surprise to me, as they're nearby Hunterdon County, where I am from. And typically whatever's going on in Hunterdon can be counted upon in those other two regions. 60% of the swarms reported so far are medium in size, with larger being the second largest input at 30%. Beekeepers have had it easier so far this year, with a full 50% of the swarms being less than 6 foot from the ground. We know traditionally swarms are reported until about the first week in July, based on the last 2 years of data. We had around 25 swarms reported last May in total, and we're on track possibly to have 35 to 40 this May. So that's good. The first year we had numbers, second year we kind of had and some. This year we have a little more than that. Each year we grow a little more. And my hope is to drive awareness around New Jersey and establish some trending over, say, a 10-year period when we get there, and have people routinely reporting their swarms. To that end, I see some swarms reported on various Facebook pages for bee clubs around the web, and many of them are not ending up on the swarm report, which is an exercise in frustration for me. I have a bit of hesitation to stalk people and ask them to report. Sometimes I'll make a mention of the New Jersey swarm report, and other times I'll just let it ride. It's not my style to hound people and peruse Facebook each night to have people reporting their swarms. I'm not that fastidious about this. But if you're in New Jersey, perhaps you can help me and stalk people on my behalf. No, I'm only kidding. There is a little truth to that, though. I'd love for people to get the word out to any of the clubs in the Garden State or people who are not part of associations. If you can, let people know. We'd really appreciate it. NJSwarm.com. Just click on the link. 5 simple questions, in and out, no muss, no fuss, and you'll help us understand what's going on in the state of New Jersey from swarming. Roundtable number 2, call this one Water Bucket Dilemma. I've talked so much about providing water to the bees on this podcast that I feel like I'm being redundant sometimes. Yeah, simple bucket with some holes in it and floaties, yada, yada, yada. The funny thing is, given how dry it is this spring here in New Jersey, I found a bit of a problem with my approach to putting water out for the bees. I put a bucket out for the 3rd season in a row, and this time I took some of my own advice and spiked the water with a little bit of sugar solution to make it more attractive. Well, good. It worked. I actually saw bees using it. However, to my dismay, the water has been dirty, and my guess is raccoons are using it to clean off their food. The past 2 weeks, a new problem has occurred. Something drank all the water and the floaties are gone. Yeah, the bucket's empty and the floaties are chewed up and all over the ground. That's not good eats. I'm going to have to rethink my strategy. Perhaps some sort of above-ground water contraption or something. My bees, because they don't have a water source, have been going to... Yep, you guessed it, my pool cover, which still has water on it and provides the perfect bee waterer. Maybe I should just keep the pool closed, not open it this year, and leave it to the bees. Yep, that's a true beekeeper notion. I think it's time to build that in-ground water feature that I've been dreaming of. My life, if you haven't guessed it, is one beekeeping segment after another. Roundtable number 3, call this one 500K. I posted our YouTube channel yesterday, a new video, and was pleasantly surprised to see that our channel has just crossed over 500,000 views. In YouTube lore, I'm not sure if that's a big deal or not, but to me it's a relevant milestone that the NWNJBA can be proud of. Speaking of YouTube... 2 weeks ago or so, I reached out to Bill, a beekeeper in Portland, Oregon. Bill is the host of The Bee Vlog, V-L-O-G. It's a video log, YouTube channel, and he, too, I see is approaching 500K viewership. Bill's been hosting his channel about beekeeping exploits since 2012, and I wrote him to thank him for a video I saw on his channel. And I actually spoke to him by phone, asking him if he'd like to chat with me about his efforts in producing his bee vlog. He was willing, and I was supposed to call him back, but have been delinquent in setting something up because just too many things going on in this world. I feel really guilty about that, Bill. Sorry. I still have it on my agenda to call you back when I find a hole, but I know next weekend is booked, and the weekend after that is the June meeting, so I'll do my best at some point to find a hole for you. I know Bill's a listener of the podcast, so sorry about that, Bill. It's been a crazy time for me, and I haven't found that window of opportunity. Either way, he's been posting videos on various topics, and I'm always intrigued at what he's up to. I love his content and production, and he's always into various things, which is why I really like going over there. One of his recent videos is of a bee lab visit and is a short documentary of a bee dissection, which is a little bit squeamish if you're that way, but it's actually really cool. Yeah. Check it out by looking up The Bee Vlog, THEBEE, V as in Victor, LOG on YouTube. And Bill, when I get a breather, I'll give you a call back. We'll provide a link in our show notes. And we'll leave the light on for you. It always sounds like a Motel 6 commercial. Okay. Next roundtable topic. Roundtable number 4, if I have my numbering right. This one's actually a plug for our YouTube channel. YouTube.com/NWNJBA. If you haven't been over there in a while, go take a peek. I recently captured that swarm, shot a video of it. I talked about a hive box building jig that I built over the winter, shot a video of it. We were out at the mentoring hives, shot a video of it. Did a top bar package install, shot a video of it. I think you're getting the picture here. I've been doing inspections. If you want to see the local hive report in all its glory, you can go take a look. You'll see me make that split that I talk about, put it in the nuke. Today I'm going to go out and probably film some on those splits and how they're doing. Shot a video of it. So you could go take a look. I'm also doing a package hive video series of, I mentioned it earlier, of that package hive, just seeing how it progresses. So between episodes, you jones for something to keep yourself posted with the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. Go take a look at youtube.com/NWNJBA. And no, I don't look like I sound, I guess. So, just a short little plug. There's a bunch of new stuff up there. Go take a peek. Roundtable number 5. This one's called Swarm Trapping. A listener named Bonnie, she didn't give me her last name, wrote in to tell us that she saw a feature on the Gadget Garage concerning the fiber plant container swarm traps. She made 5 of them and shares that by the second week they were up, she caught 3 swarms. My guess is she saw them on that YouTube channel that I was just talking about. The episode's coming full circle. In the last roundtable, she situated them according to Tom Seeley's research, after taking notes from his Honeybee Democracy book. She also purchased an inspection light based on Bob Kloss's guidance. He's the one that showed us the fiber plant swarm trap thingies. And she used those to look in the chamber to see if they were honeybees and or they were something else. And I guess in some occasions she did find something else. That'd be a heck of a surprise to open a swarm trap only to find a wasp nest. So yeah, it's probably a good idea to have some sort of recon device. The traps cost her around $55. That includes the foam insulation spray and rope. She said she had some Thompson's water seal. And the light contraption was $73. And for about $125 total, she bagged $450 worth of bees. As she puts it, pretty cool. She said, I bought the inspection light at Harbor Freight. and I don't know which one she's talking about, so I guess I can't provide a link. I'll look to see if I can find it. If so, I'll put something in the show notes. So, Bonnie, thanks for writing in. Bob did get to see the message, and he was pretty excited that you had great success with that. These little things make the efforts that we take all very much worthwhile. Looking at the clock, I see I'm at 1:20. That's a long episode. One of the longer ones we've had in a while. I'm out of topics, folks. Time to close it out. And one little thing to note is the Be Informed partnership data has been circulating. I know the BIP report was released recently. I haven't had a chance to delve into it, so likely you'll have to wait till episode 79. I did see some of the preliminary information, interesting dynamics, and maybe it's just me, but it seems they have become the soundbite authority for the mainstream press, which I see as a good thing. I've had people stop me in the coffee room and ask me if I hear about the decline, and did you know that most bees are lost during the summer? So it's so interesting that some of their messaging just gets parroted back out to the general public. I guess when I go to the fair this year and I'm working in the bee booth, I can expect to hear that information and have questions about why are bees dying in the summertime. Today is Memorial Day. I said I'm recording this on Memorial Day morning 2015. It's actually wandered into afternoon. I always reflect on this day and reflect on those who provide services to our country for our defense and support our way of life. In my youth, in those days when life and direction were uncertain for me, I entertained notions of joining the military. I was always intrigued by my young impressions of fitness and discipline that would have come if I joined, but that world always scared me at the possibility of sacrifice given the volatility of the times of when I grew up, and I guess the times that we live in today and any other time as I think about it. As I am older and wiser, I still reflect on my hesitancy and gives me pause to give credence to the courage of those who serve, and especially those who have made the ultimate sacrifice for our country. I think about families who have lost loved ones and even those significant others of servicemen and women whose lives were altered forever by a change in destiny. It's a sad notion in my mind, but I can only hope that those who have lost can find solace in the pride in the service and sacrifice of others. Not to end on a somber note, let me throw a couple other quick reflections in here. First thing is, I had a problem with the feed for the podcast over the last couple episodes. I found out through serendipity that the last two episodes were not listed on the production site, and especially in iTunes, where I think most people get the podcast. Sorry about that. There's this thing called an RSS feed, which is written in XML, and it's really finicky. And if you get the context of a date wrong or anything, it completely discards the entry. And that was the cause for the problem. A number of you were probably very surprised when two episodes suddenly appeared and have been wondering where I was. And that is the reason for it. It's all resolved now, and hopefully the errors will not crop up anytime soon. I have one more note for this podcast. The opening music is Huey Lewis and the News, my favorite band. And I always follow Huey Lewis through the summer. He's out touring. He's playing in Texas. He's playing with Jimmy Buffett on May 30th. That's interesting. That would be a neat show. Goes out to Oklahoma, and he's in Missouri, Hollywood, Orlando, Florida. He's making his way up through the East Coast. June 16th, he's in Virginia. Then June 17th and 19th, he's playing in New Jersey. Have to chat with Sharon when she gets home to see if she's interested in that. Pennsylvania, Maryland, D.C., Canada, Maine, and so on, going through the rest of the summer. You could check it out at his website. Young, old, doesn't matter. Huey Lewis has the best music for anybody. Go check them out. And that is a great way to end the episode. It's afternoon time, looking forward to going upstairs, grabbing a little bit of lunch, going out, working in the garage, and checking on my bees. Thanks for coming in and listening to the podcast. I appreciate all the support we get. And I'll leave you with this. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, and be well, everybody.